Well, turning now to the decision makers, Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas is one of three Massachusetts representatives who voted for the debt ceiling deal in the House. We asked her why.
We never should have ended up in this position, but that was not something we could change despite all our best efforts. So I thought fundamentally it was important that we take responsibility for our decisions that we've made in the past and pay our bills.
Now, President Obama has said the deal is far from perfect. I gather you agree. Who's going to feel the effect of this deal the most?
Well, obviously, it's not perfect. I think we all wanted to work very hard to be sure that new revenue was on the table as part of this discussion, you know, whether it's addressing the tax cuts for the wealthiest of Americans or eliminating some of the most egregious subsidies, for example, to big oil and big gas or agribusiness. And in the first cuts, that is not the case. But the bipartisan committee that is part of this effort is not precluded from addressing revenue as part of its efforts to come up with $1.2 trillion in cuts. And so the fight will move there as we go forward.
Congresswoman, let me just ask you, though, about the process and just how it looked to many Americans. In the end, we got a deal. But, you know, this came right up to the edge within hours of possible default. A deal was reached. But should the American people conclude that it looks like this system in Washington isn't working, that it's close to being broken?
Bottom line was, this was a debate, and debate will go on about deeply held beliefs about what is the role of the federal government. So at the best case scenario, I think the American people want us to go and fight hard for whatever their particular beliefs may be. That being said, though, the House of Representatives and the United States Senate are institutions that are built upon the capacity to compromise. Mm-hmm. And what we saw too often was a significant number of members on the Republican side of the aisle who simply refused to compromise. And it has led to a kind of brinksmanship that was not been helpful to the institution and certainly not helpful to our country at a very critical moment in its history.
Hmm. Now, the New York Times editorial page this week said that President Obama could have been more adamant in dealing with the Republicans. It suggested he could have threatened to go around Congress altogether in raising the debt limit. What do you think? Could the president have been stronger in handling this?
Well, the issue of the 14th Amendment and the president's authority under that did come up in the course of this. But I think we have a country that's built upon all three branches of the government working together, given the strongly held beliefs that so many have that are currently elected. I think the more appropriate way was to move through the legislative process working with the president and not having to resort to the possible authority he has under the 14th Amendment.
Of course, working through the legislative process, at least this time around, it seems like that the deal was driven so much by a relatively small number of Tea Party-backed Republicans in the House, which leads to this question. Was the final result here what most Americans wanted?
Well, I believe, and as I voted not to default, that in the course of the discussion we've had over this, more and more Americans came to appreciate what was at stake in the event that we defaulted.
Well, Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony.
That's Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, a Massachusetts Democrat. Another view now from Congressman Barney Frank, who voted against the bill. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you.
So we just heard from your colleague Nikki Tsongas, who said that she voted for the bill because it was preferable to a default. You voted against it. Was default preferable to this deal?
That's a tough question. Unfortunately, marginally, yes. I very much want to avoid default, and I was prepared to vote for a bill that had a number of things in it that I oppose that would have avoided default. But I believe that the single biggest spending problem we have now is the virtually unlimited amounts that are spent on the military. There are open-ended military commitments, and we are way overextended. And I do not believe it will be possible to reduce the deficit and maintain our basic responsibilities to each other.
Congressman, let me ask you, would you have opposed this if you had been the deciding vote, if it had been so close that your vote could have been the decisive vote?
Sadly, yes, because I think we would have been able to immediately recoup it. But I have to tell you, here's the dilemma that you posed to me. I was prepared to recognize that when you're dealing with people ready to destroy the government, you may have to give in a little bit more. But there are limits. And I think, you know, you're not just thinking about this one set of issues. I think we have set a bad precedent in that the most irresponsible and extreme people, the people who quite explicitly have an agenda that government's a bad thing and should be reduced and reduced and reduced and don't differentiate between waste and firefighting, that they set a precedent in which they can continue to make these demands. And sometimes a short-term bit of pain is necessary to arrest a long-term serious illness. But yeah, I guess what you're telling me is this. Let me reverse the question to you. You are apparently saying to me that no matter what was in this bill, we should have voted for it because default would be so terrible.
No, and Congressman, I'm certainly not saying that.
No, yes, you are.
No, I'm asking the question because it's a tough question. You guys are in a tough position.
That. It's one you don't want to answer. Look, I understand the ethos, which is journalists ask tough questions and never have to answer them. Look, there were people, including the president, to my dismay, who wanted to reduce the cost of living that elderly people get. To tell a 78-year-old woman making $19,000 a year that she wouldn't get much of an increase. Well, the logic of your question is, I should have voted for that if that's what it took. And I think once you accept that, then you have made it much more likely that you're going to have a series of those terrible choices.
No, Congressman, point taken. And let me hazard another tough question, and I want to ask you the same question I asked Tsongas. Could President Barack Obama have been stronger in negotiating with the Republicans? What's your view on that? He's caught some flack from the left about this.
I think that's a little unfair. Here's the deal. We believe that coming together and pooling our resources, which we call government, is essential to have a civilized society. So what I'm saying is that was a disadvantage the president was at. You have one group prepared to blow things up, and unfortunately, they get an advantage. One other very important point here that this sets up, we're going to have a very serious debate from now until the election of 2012 on what is the appropriate level of government and how much you fund it, because two things are now going to happen. One, the Bush tax cuts expire. Two, if the special committee isn't able to come to a deal, six Democrats, six Republicans, an across-the-board cut in all kinds of spending will happen. So I have some optimism that we're going to have, for the first time in this country, a serious debate on what the public wants. And unfortunately, I think the public hasn't been forced to make their choice.
Last question, Congressman, about that debate going forward. Given what's happened, given what we've all witnessed, it doesn't appear like there's a climate down there in Washington for substantive debate.
Let me differ with you. Washington is not on Mars. The climate in Washington is reflective of the climate in the country. We did not in Washington decide to create the Tea Party. Washington did not elect to Congress a group of people who have this very negative view of government and a lack of civility. Now, and I say that because if this is considered to be some malfunction in Washington that has no roots in the country as a whole, we will be misunderstood. And no, I think that many of us will make sure that is the debate, to say to people, okay, if you want this level of services, we're going to need this level of taxation. Let's debate that.
All right. Congressman Barney Frank, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Always a pleasure. Congressman Barney Frank represents Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District. He voted against the budget deal that's now been signed into law by President Obama. So let's go a bit deeper into what just happened in Washington. For months, lawmakers have been engaged in a rancorous and divisive debate about the role of government, spending, and the debt, while the clock ticked down toward a possible default. In the end, as we've been reporting, lawmakers avoided that potential calamity and passed a budget deal that cuts government spending by more than $2 trillion. So here's the question. Does that mean the system worked, messy as it was? To help us with that and other questions, we're joined here in the studio by David King. He's a lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's also the faculty chair for the program for newly elected members of Congress. And he's also a co-author of a book about congressional committees and co-edited a book called Why Don't People Trust Government? David King, welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us from WNPR in Hartford is Bill Curry. He's a former counselor to President Bill Clinton. He advised him during the government shutdown of 1996. He also ran twice for governor of Connecticut, and he's currently writing a book about the Obama administration. Welcome, Bill Curry. Thanks for joining us on Radio Boston.
Great to be here, Anthony. Thank you.
And listeners, you can join the conversation. Do you think the system worked? And have we been down this road before? Has Washington, or maybe the country, ever appeared so divided as it does today? You can give us a call and join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So, gentlemen, Bill, David, let me start with you, David. Let's start with that basic question. We came to the brink of a government default. All kinds of financial setbacks would have followed. In the end, we got a budget deal. So setting aside political preferences, political biases, did the system work?
Oh, not really. I think Americans have every right and every reason to be outraged. In a way, it worked only if you don't remember the nightmare that we've been through for the last few days, for the last few weeks. If you wake up refreshed like Rip Van Winkle, it seemed like a pretty good slumber. But this was a disaster in most respects and shows Congress at its very worst.
Bill Curry, do you agree?
I do. This is, first of all, 4 months that we've spent on a problem of our own creation, that the Congress itself created out of thin air. We then debated it in a most unbecoming way with the whole world watching and, of course, the American electorate. And then we arrived at the wrong solution. So to say that it worked, as you know, Senator McConnell said today, yes, this warts and all, this is our democracy. For the American people are more in the position of a parent who comes home and finds that the children have ransacked the house. the parent's not going to give them ice cream just because they didn't also burn it down. This has been I think the public reaction will be pretty much as David just said. People are going to look at this and see, wow, how could this possibly be handled in such a slovenly and partisan way as you have?
But let me throw this push back a little bit. You mentioned Senator Mitch McConnell, the minority leader who played a big role in hammering out this compromise. And he said, you know, I was just reading comments. He put it this way. Their goal was to get as much spending cuts as they could. It may have been messy, he said. It may have appeared that government wasn't working. But in fact, the opposite is true. Legislating was never meant to be pretty. David King, I mean, does he have at least part of a point there? I mean, the minority party used the legislative system to win, and that's the way the system was set up in many ways.
Well, in some ways, yes. I think with Senator McConnell, though, he's telling himself a story that he wants to believe so he can live with what's actually happened. It's certainly true that he helped to usher in or helped to bring this to a resolution, but nobody can look at what has happened and say, hey, it's just sausage making. Sausage making is a fine art, a delicate and wonderful smelling art compared to what we've seen out of Washington recently.
Barney Frank, Bill Curry, made an interesting point just moments ago to rebut suggestions that Washington is somehow dysfunctional. He said Washington didn't elect the Tea Party members, regular voters did. So this gets to another very basic question that I want to put to both of you. Does the result in Washington in some way represent what the American people wanted? Bill Curry.
First of all, the American people do want lower taxes, and there is going to be a debate, I hope, within the Democratic Party about the degree to which we can, in fact, advance social issues in this country and advance our economic interest through changing rules rather than spending money. We're going to be broke for a while, and the question, I think, is always, you know, you can either make the change or write the check. The problem for the Democrats is that they're caving to the Tea Party and Wall Street at the same time. And it makes the kind of fundamental restructurings of energy, transportation, healthcare, et cetera, virtually impossible. And so we are going to have to face up to this question of finite resources. And the second thing we have to do, by the way, is just defend the role of government. It's not just the government that's broken. It's the market that's broken from Enron. To Lehman Brothers. We've lived through a half a generation of this now and still talk exclusively as if this problem were in the government. Markets create wealth, but they don't distribute it. It's the government that's responsible for that and for distributing power and opportunity and for making sure there's a middle class. The government's been too lax on the markets, and some Democrat, starting with the president, I think, has to get up and start saying that loudly so that people can hear it and understand it.
Well, that's the debate that I guess, I mean, for instance, we just heard both Nikki Tsongas and Barney Frank talking about this is the debate they want to have going forward. David King, I mean, given what we've seen in Washington, is there any reason to believe that we have a climate for that kind of debate?
Well, I think it's possible now with the Senate, with the Select Committee, the Joint Select Committee that'll be with 12 people. They have to report out of their committees by December 9th, and then it goes to the floor of the House and the Senate. Can't be amended. Has to be straight up or down. It can't be filibustered. So these will be serious people doing very serious work. And then in the second and third week of December, we'll either have a wonderful Christmas presents called, you know, an interesting dialogue and some kind of a deliberation, or it's going to be a very nasty start to the primary season, which would only be a month away.
Well, you've looked at these committees and done a lot of studying on them. Is this a good mechanism to deal with this kind of issue, these kinds of these vexing issues about how to balance cuts between spending and taxes and so forth and so on?
Well, we haven't tried one quite like this before. There have been committees outside of Congress, commissions, the Base Realignment Commission, for example, that then had to come in and be a straight up or down vote. But to have a bill that comes in from a select committee and binds the committees of jurisdiction, this is new. And it's going to be very interesting to see whether it works. It's a way for Congress as a whole to say, we can't trust ourselves. You better just let the grown-ups take care of this and see whether or not we can get anything done. I think this is going to be a great test for the United States Congress going into the presidential elections.
Listeners, we're talking about today's historic resolution, really, of the debt ceiling crisis. Congress may have reached a compromise. The president may have signed a new law on the debt ceiling, but the debate is still very much alive across the nation. And we're asking if the system worked or if things are about to get a whole lot messier across this country. That's what we're focusing on today. I'm joined by David King, lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and Bill Curry, former counselor to President Bill Clinton. And Bill, you advised former President Clinton during the government shutdown of 1996. That was certainly, at least in recent memory, one of those historic moments where you had this, folks just butting heads down there in Washington. Any interesting observations or parallels between those days and today?
I think, first of all, I have to say that I believe the Obama political team made a mistake in thinking that merely appearing to be reasonable, which is the storyline of that fight, and which is true, but it's only partly true, that merely being reasonable on the president's part would suffice to get him through this and to compare him favorably to the Congress. But I'll just point out a couple of things. Number one, we were running against Bob Dole, and he was in the room, and therefore having to take all the flack. He couldn't be like Mitt Romney or all these Republicans, whether candidates for president, whether they were speaking on this or not. They weren't in the news. No one really knows what any of them thought. And so Obama did better than the Republicans in Congress, but he suffered proportionally with them vis-a-vis the rest of the field. We had Dole in the room. Big difference. Secondly, during the 6 months in which that fight really from beginning to end went on, unemployment dropped 1.3% in the United States. And the president's rising favorabilities during that period certainly are partly attributable to that, and Obama doesn't have that advantage. The last thing, though, that's really important, if I could just say this quickly. During
sure.
those negotiations, I was in a series of meetings with Trent Lott while Dole and Gingrich were meeting with the president. We were having sidecar meetings about what a deal might really look like. And I made a number of arguments to him at that time, and I don't think I ever impressed him with a single argument. I don't think anything I said ever moved him. But we were running advertising, and we were running an entire argument to the American people. We realized that we were negotiating not with the Republicans but with the public, and that if the public was on our side, they would negotiate with the Republicans. It seems to me that this is something which even after 3 years in office, the president's team does not understand. There's no one in that room who wants to negotiate with him or to compromise with him. Nobody in the room wishes him well in those negotiations. He has to be bringing this case on this and every issue to the public. It's how reformers – it's the only way reformers ever win.
David King, a criticism there of the way President Obama has interfaced or not interfaced, I guess, with the public. Do you agree with that? What's your view?
No, I have a different read on it. I think the President Obama had to go to the American public, which we saw him do fairly clearly. Now, he is in a position to show himself to be a leader, right, with a fairly clear image of what he wanted. He wanted a deal done that would be fair. But then a leader also in a legislative setting cuts deals behind closed doors, and that's exactly what he did in this case. The president does have to speak to the voters. It's not just the American public. And we heard it from the Barney Frank interview you did just a few minutes ago. The folks who elected the Tea Party representatives are not unlike the folks who elected Barney Frank. They represent a very specific slice of Americana. And our country is represented by people who vote in political primaries. And moderates aren't in primaries. Candidates aren't moderates. And so we have in Washington today extremes, extreme of the left, extreme of the right. But when you have wing nuts actually running for office and only them voting in the primaries, it's no surprise.
So, and I want to actually invite our listeners into this conversation. We're talking about this historic compromise today, and we're asking if this represents the system working or something else. You can give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Just to follow up on that, David King, this idea, though, of this debate being dominated by a very small group of Republicans on the Tea Party end of the debate. Is that normal? I mean, I'm asking you, I guess, to go back in history a little bit and talk about where we have seen these kinds of divisions in the past.
Well, there's a sense in which this kind of dynamic is relatively normal in that people with the most intensely held preferences are those who are going to be able to move policy the most. Mm. And so, you know, maybe that's what a representative republic is supposed to do, not simply reflect what everybody wants, you know, the mushy middle, but people who really have strongly held preferences, very much for or against something. So democracy is about both preferences and how much you believe in something. However, that said, what we're seeing in Washington now, this great division, this remarkable polarization, the heated rhetoric, this is the fourth time by my counting in American history that we've been to this point. Hmm. The first was in the early 1800s, before the emergence of the Democratic Party in the election of Jackson in 1828. The second was just before the Civil War, when the Whigs and the Democrats had such a deep division that, of course, results in a major fracture in the country. The third was in the late 1920s, where for a number of reasons, the rich and poor divide was very great, the urban-rural divide very great, the Protestant-Catholic divide very great, and that led to a new epoch of the New Deal reforms. And now, for the first time in your lifetime and mine, we're back with that level of polarization again. The last three times it's led to dramatic change in this country. I would suspect it's going to do the same this time.
Mm. Bill Curry, chime in here on this polarization that we've
things.
Been seeing.
I don't have quite as dark feelings as David does on this. And I do credit the president with having taken a position of reason and having been the adult in the room, and I think that will serve him well. I hope that it serves him well in the debate that's ahead. This has been a very particular situation. You know, if you have a hostage taker holding a family, in a house, and the person may be a completely economically, psychologically, and intellectually marginal, but if he has a gun and he's already shot the dog, all the SWAT teams in the world outside are basically at deuce with him. And although he won't have a lot of influence in the long term, he has an awful lot of power in the short term. They did have the ability on this one issue to wreak havoc, and it is not surprising that the adults blinked first. That's part of being an adult, recognizing the amount of risk. Mm. Secondly, I just want to say that I don't find the polarization to be as deep in this country. There is certainly a faction which has stayed in the 20 to 30% range for nearly a century, which is as conservative as the faction that won out here. And even among those people, they're not all quite so bitter and polarized. I often just tell people, when you bracket for a moment the images of Americans you see on cable television or in politics, get them out of your head if you can, and just picture instead all the people you've actually met in your life. And the first thing you'll conclude is that we don't hate each other in real life nearly as much as we do on cable television.
Go ahead. Just finish that thought. I'm sorry.
And that there's an open-mindedness and a good-heartedness, and there is a desire for consensus on the American people that we can tap.
Well, amen, and let's hope you're right. Let's get some callers into this conversation. Let's go to Joe, who's calling from Hudson, New Hampshire. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
I would like to say that I think the system did work, and I think you have to realize that the level of borrowing that the government has been going through is not sustainable. And rather than just without a blink pass the next increase, I think it was critical that the country face the fact that you cannot indefinitely continue to borrow. As you know, the interest payments on the debt are already extraordinarily high, and they will continue to get high as we borrow more and more. And if we ran our home budget like that, we'd be bankrupt before you know it. I mean, I can probably get more credit at home than I deserve, but I still have to deal with the consequences of having to pay that money back and pay the interest. And I have to deal with, do I want to try to get another job to pay, get more revenue,
yep,
or do I want to cut expenses? This is exactly what's going on in the government.
Well, Joe, we appreciate the call, and let me put your thought to David King. There's Joe saying the system worked, that the priority was to cut spending. That's what this deal did.
Well, the system certainly works in terms of the policy for Joe, and the policy, most Americans are probably in favor of where we are. We can't afford the kind of government that we have right now unless we cut more or raise more money. I think the part that did not work is not about policy, it's about process, the way that we went to finally reach that outcome. I do want to just get back to something that Bill said a few moments ago in talking about hostage taking. I think that is itself a remarkably dark way of imagining or picturing the representatives from the Tea Party or any other group. We do have polarization, and one looks at one party versus another party in all of our state legislatures and in the U.S. Congress with their highest levels of polarization since the 1920s. But to castigate one side as sort of hostage takers and dogs would have to attack, I think the extremists on either side can be characterized that way. And I'm less interested in policy than I am in process. And I think we need to find ways to be more inclusive and have reasonable debates and then come to good policy.
Let me
defend myself there for a second. I agree entirely. I wish the president, by the way, had begun this process by proposing $1 trillion in long-term cuts on his own. In introducing discussion over the debt ceiling. And I'm in many ways impressed with the Tea Party people. It's nice to see somebody in Washington standing up for their principles. I can think of many principles of my own that I wish I'd seen people fight that hard for. And I didn't. I didn't mean to be doing the Joe Biden, these are terrorists thing. I completely agree with you. We have to respect one another. We need civility. I was looking there, though, to explain why they had disproportionate leverage right now, because they would do something that was less – they were able to convince their opponents that they were willing to be more irresponsible and therefore more destructive. And because of that, they had an amount of leverage that they're not going to have on the next vote. I do believe that these are idealistic people. And that some of their views represent the views of a majority of Americans, without a doubt.
Let's try to get one more call into this conversation at least. Peter from Roslindale, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to just make a point. I've heard that you on this show refer to this as a compromise, and it is in no way a compromise, and I think the media has some role in shaping how the public thinks about this. This was, I do believe, hostage-taking and a complete cave by the Democrats and Obama, and I don't see any way that you can characterize this as a compromise.
All right, Peter. Well, we'll take that up. I know, David, you don't want to talk so much about policy, but can you make Peter feel a little better? Was there any element of this that represented a compromise or not so much?
Well, we'd have to worry about definitions. Obviously, it had support from members of both parties. And both parties did get something that they wanted. The Democrats were very much in favor of this select joint committee that doesn't really kick the can that far down the road and is going to have to come up with $1.5 trillion in savings over the next 10 years, that's a very significant opportunity for the Democrats to have some serious work, some real inroads. I think it was a compromise, and we just have to keep the conversation going.
Bill Curry, we literally have 10 seconds left. I want to give you sort of the last few seconds here to talk about what's going to happen in these days and weeks ahead. Any reason for optimism at all?
Sure. It's America, and we're optimistic by nature. It's going to depend upon how this committee is appointed. And it's going to depend in part upon what they see happening all around them in the economy. And above all, it's going to depend upon the ability of the president to reframe this debate for the American people. That's what has to happen next for a number of reasons.
Bill Curry, former counselor to President Bill Clinton. He's also currently writing a book about the Obama administration. Thanks so much for joining us today, Bill. Much appreciated.
I had a ball. Thank you, Anthony.
And David King, lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the co-author of a book about congressional committee and co-editor of Why People Don't Trust Government. David King, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And I think we made a case that while there were certainly it was a troubling experience watching some of the sausage making, all hope is not lost. After a break in the season of Ramadan, we'll visit a traditional iftar feast with members of the Boston Muslim community. I'm Anthony Brooks with Adam Ragusa. This is Radio Boston.